I just want to summarize what we accomplished yesterday with Higgs to glue glue, Higgs decaying into two gluons. It came from a one-loop diagram involving a top quark. So just to remind you, we had a diagram like this with the top quark in the loop. And there was another diagram as well, looked kind of similar. And then through some effort, we computed the matrix element. We squared it, summed over all of the final states, colors, and polarizations. And we computed the decay rate for Higgs to two gluons. And it had the following expression, alpha s squared mh cubed over 64 pi cubed v squared. Okay, this is only true at leading order. There's some QCD corrections that might change this by a bit. But one thing you might notice is we put the top quark in the loop. The final result doesn't depend on the top quark. So it's just asked the question, you know, why do we care about the top quark, given that doesn't really care about the mass of the top in our final expression? Shouldn't we be summing over all of the different quarks that we can have? All of the quarks have mass in all of them, therefore coupled to the Higgs. So the answer is no, and implicitly there is a very significant dependence on the mass of the quark in the loop, which we kind of swept under the rug, and this came from the loop integral. So remember we had to do this, evaluate this integral. Over the Feynman parameters. Then we had 1 minus 4 xz over 1 minus, well, I can write it this way, 1 minus xz times a factor of mh squared over mq squared. So here, let me be a little bit more general and say that we put an arbitrary quark q in the loop. Then we just replace mt by mq, and the loop integral we have to evaluate looks like this. So what we did before is we assumed that mq was, for the top, much larger than the mass of the Higgs. So in that limit, mq squared much greater than mh squared, the result for this integral was just 1/3. But now, if you don't make that assumption, then you get a different answer that depends on the mass of the quark. And so the general expression is a bit complicated. You can do the integral, but it's just useful to see what you get in the case that the quark mass is much lighter than the mass of the Higgs squared. For all of the other quarks, except for the top quark, this is definitely true. What you get is 1/2 mq squared over mh squared times the log of the log squared of mh squared over mq squared. So if you're in this limit where the quarks are light, this expression, this integral, is proportional to the quark mass squared. It would go to zero. So it's a small for light quarks. By light, I just mean less than the Higgs mass. Usually you don't call the bottom quark a light quark, but in this case it is. Okay, so all the other quarks except for the top give a very small contribution, which is why you can neglect it. Well, let me make one other point. So I mentioned before that Higgs to glue glue gives you a probe of the Higgs coupling to the top quark. Okay, it's nice because the Higgs can't decay directly into top quarks. However, it's not a direct probe of the top coupling. You could call it an indirect probe. And the reason is that if you measure Higgs to glue glue, you don't necessarily know what is in the loop. there could be other states as well in the loop. And just by measuring Higgs-Glugler, you can't pick out what is correct. Yes?
To be sure, whatever is in the loop cannot be another quark than the top. Like, it cannot be other quarks.
Yeah, if there is something in the loop giving a large contribution, it has to be something new.
Okay.
Okay, so that's where I'm going. So this is one of the tests of the standard model. We want to measure all of the different couplings. So measuring Higgs to glu-glu is one coupling you can measure, but it's sensitive not just to the Higgs top coupling, but to new states that you could have outside of the standard model. For example, anything that carries color and also interacts with the Higgs would contribute to Higgs to glu-glu. You could write down a loop diagram. So different examples could be, do you want to interrupt? Yeah. Let me finish this comment, then you can ask. Different examples that you can have are, for example, you could have new states such as supersymmetric particles, which might carry color. Those would contribute to the loop. You'll have to do a homework exercise on that. But another example of states you could have that would contribute is just a fourth generation. So we have three generations of fermions in the standard model. Why not more? Maybe they're just very heavy, so we haven't found them yet. But if they couple like the standard model, then they would also contribute to this diagram. And if all of them are heavy, you would get a large contribution for all of those different terms. You would have a 1/3 for every additional quark that's heavy that couples to the Higgs. So measuring this coupling constrains all sorts of different new physics scenarios, in addition to constraining the coupling of the Higgs to the top. Okay, question?
Maybe a layman question, but we don't have Higgs in the lab like this, so how can we show that we have a Higgs decay? Like, we need to produce the Higgs.
Yes, that's right.
It's very easy to produce Higgs.
Yes, we're going to come to that exact question. But what I want to say is that Higgs to glu-glu is essentially unobservable, because I mentioned this before, but when you collide two protons together, you'll get lots of hadronic stuff coming out. You'll get lots of gluons coming out and lots of quarks. How do you know that they came from the Higgs? The fraction of gluons coming from the Higgs compared to all other processes is very, very small. So this process is actually probably impossible to observe. But we're going to show that this is the most important process for producing the Higgs. It's not the decays that are interesting, it's the inverse decays, where you have two gluons coming together to produce the Higgs boson. So this is what we'll discuss now, production. And we're going to specialize to hadron colliders. Just because the LHC is a hadron collider, and that's what's running now. So the LHC is a proton-proton collider. And it started out at a center of mass energy of 7 TeV, then it went to 8 TeV, and now it's at 13 TeV. And the question we want to ask is, what is the cross-section? For producing Higgs bosons. And how many Higgs bosons are produced in the experiment? Now, there's many different ways to produce the Higgs boson. So I'm going to list them all. This is in order of importance. By order of importance, I just mean which ones give the largest rates. So we'll start at the ones that give the largest rate and work our way down. The first one is called gluon-gluon fusion. Or GGF. And this is essentially what we just computed. It's an inverse decay, where you have two gluons coming together to produce a Higgs boson. And this dot here is supposed to represent this top loop, or whatever else we need to include that might be some new physics. Okay, so this one, we're going to compute this one, so we'll come back to it. The second most important one is called vector boson fusion. BBF. So BBF is as follows. You have two quarks in the proton, let's say a U quark and a D quark. They both radiate off W's. This would be a W plus. And this would be a W minus. And then the two W's fuse together to produce a Higgs boson. Or you could have a similar process involving the Z boson as well. So this could be a U or a D. You have two Z bosons, and they fuse together to produce a Higgs boson. Next, you have vector boson associated production. By vector boson, I'm talking about the W or the Z. So this goes under the name of WH or ZH. And the processes are you have a U or a D and a D bar and a U bar. Then here you might have a W plus or W minus, W plus and minus, and a Higgs. And this one here is virtual. Or you could have the same thing, but with the Z. Then the last process is top associated production. TTH. And in this case, you first produce a pair of top quarks. So an easy way to make top quarks at the LHC is through gluons. And then for one of your top quarks, you radiate off a Higgs boson, like this. So the final state is TTH. So you produce a Higgs in associated with a TT bar pair. Now this process, although the cross section is small, is the direct probe of the top Higgs coupling, because you're producing the top the TT bar pair in the final state. So you know that there was a coupling of the Higgs to the top in this process. Whereas for gluon gluon fusion, it could be sensitive to other physics in the loop as well. Okay. Now, all of these processes might look a little bit weird. And the reason that you have to go through, for example, these electroweak processes or through a loop is just because the Higgs at tree level only couples to states that have mass. Everything inside of the proton is very light or massless. Light quarks are gluons. And so that's why you have to go somehow through a very heavy particle, for example, through the coupling at the top which you have to generate as a virtual particle, or by first producing vector bosons and then producing the Higgs through the coupling of the Higgs to the vector bosons. The other thing to worry about are the PDFs of the proton. So you're starting out with two protons at very high energies, and so the gluon PDFs are very large. That's why gluon-gluon fusion is so large. Here, you're starting out with quarks, not anti-quarks, and so you could take advantage of the valence quark PDFs, which may be larger than those for the anti-quarks. And here, this process, which is a bit suppressed, here you have to rely on the anti-quark PDFs. Okay. So, these are all of the different processes. And you can distinguish them all to some extent experimentally just by looking for other states in the final state. Yes?
I know you said we're looking at this because of the LHC, but if these hadronizations make everything messy, why don't we look for the lepton processes with Higgs instead of?
Yeah, so one of the cleanest ways is if you had a lepton collider.
Yeah.
So an electron-positron collider. There was one running called LEP. It shut off. The maximum energy in terms of Higgs mass that it reached was around 114, 115 GeV. So if it had boosted its energy just a small little bit and kept running a little bit longer, it would have found it. But okay. You know, CERN found it anyway, so it doesn't really matter. For a lepton collider, the hierarchy of processes is a bit different. So if you had an E plus C minus collider, the most important processes are the vector boson fusion processes. So you'd have something like this, where you have a Z, and a Z, and then a Higgs. And so this potentially is a lot cleaner. The Z, especially if it would decay to leptons, is very clean. And the Higgs can also decay in very clean ways as well. So you're right, it is clean, but that doesn't mean you have to do it that way. Okay, so next, what we're going to do is compute the cross-section for producing a Higgs boson from gluon-gluon fusion. We're going to start out by computing the cross-section at the parton level, and then we'll integrate over the gluon PDFs. So we start out with this parton level cross section, which is really just an inverse decay process. So I'll just write down the formula. 1 over 2E1, 2E2, V rel. We have an integral over the single final state momentum, Q. Two pi to the fourth, delta 4 q minus p1 minus p2. We have a sum over the matrix element squared, gg producing a Higgs. And I have to sum over all the spins and all of the colors. And so I need to average over the initial spins and initial colors for the gluons. There's two polarizations, so the spin factor is 2. There's 8 colors, so there's a factor of 1 over 8 times 2. And then since we have 2 gluons, we have to square it. So let me also sketch that we have 2 gluons coming in with momentum p1 and p2. And we have a Higgs going out with momentum q. Now we'll work in the center of mass frame. In that frame, the Higgs is just at rest after it gets produced. So this relative velocity factor is just equal to 2. This factor of 4E1, E2 is just equal to Mandelstam S at the parton level. And the energy of the Higgs is just equal to MH. So now I can do the 3 momentum integral over q, using 3 out of the 4 delta functions. So I have 1 over, so if I simplify it a bit, I have pi over mh times s hat. I have a delta function of mh minus e1 minus e2. I have a 1 over 16 squared, and then I have a sum over the matrix element squared. Let me write it like this. Okay, so now what I'm going to do is the following. So if I use the fact that the Higgs coupling to gluons is invariant under time reversal, then I can just reverse the initial and final states appearing in the matrix element. And so now I've related my production process to the matrix elements for decay. And so I can relate this matrix element squared to the decay rate that I just computed. So I have the decay rate for Higgs going into two gluons. This was 1 over 32 pi mh times the sum over the matrix element squared. And so this implies that the matrix element squared is 32 pi mh times the decay rate. So now I can just plug this into here.
You always just swap points from a decay to a
production. Yeah, it has to satisfy time reversal invariance. What kind of process wouldn't satisfy it? So you'd have to look at the CP properties of the different couplings.
So CP is broken time, must be also.
Yeah, but it can be a little bit more subtle than that, because if you only have one coupling appearing, then essentially when you complex conjugate a complex parameter, it's not going to matter. I should say, when you take the magnitude squared of that complex parameter, it's not really going to matter. So it's only really going to be an issue if you have sort of an interference term between two different processes with different CP properties. So in this case, it doesn't really matter. Okay. Now, let me express what we get for this cross-section now. So plugging in for the width, we have this cross section is, so simplifying it a bit, we have Higgs to glue over 16 S hat. And then we have a delta function of MH minus E1 plus E2. That's just the square root of S hat. Okay. Now I want to simplify the delta function a little bit. So I can use the following identity. The delta of S hat minus the square root of S hat minus MH is equal to this delta function of S hat minus MH squared times 2 times the square root of S hat. And so now I can plug this in to my cross section. And this is pi squared gamma takes to glue glue over 8 times MH times a delta function of S hat minus MH squared. Okay, so this is the part done level cross section. Now, we want to compute a hadron level process. We have to integrate over the PDFs. So that's what we'll do. So here's the process we want to consider. We have a proton, two protons colliding. So schematically, it looks like this. And this momentum will be P1. This momentum will be P2. And we have two gluons that fuse together to produce the Higgs boson. And in the spirit of what we did before with deep inelastic scattering, we don't really care about all the hadronic stuff that's going to come out from the proton. So we'll compute an inclusive cross-section that's just going to sum over all possible hadronic final states. So in the language of factorization, by making that assumption, of course, the probability of hadronization is equal to 1. So the cross-section for this process inclusive cross section where X is all hadronic final states . So I just need to compute the parton level cross section, which I just put in, and then I just need to integrate over the relevant PDFs. So here, x1 and x2 are going to be the momentum fractions carried by the initial state partons. And fg is just the gluon PDF. So with deep inelastic scattering, we only had to integrate over one PDF. Here we have two protons, and so we have to integrate over two PDFs. Capital P1 and 2 are the initial proton momenta. And little P1 and 2 are the initial gluon momenta. So this is just little x 1 and 2 times big P 1 and 2. So now what I need to do is relate the parton level quantities here to the hadron level quantities. So S hat is P1 plus P2 squared. So this is 2P1 divided into P2, since the gluons are massless. This is 2X1, X2 times big P1 times big P2. And the center of mass energy at the LHC is much larger than the proton mass. So I can neglect the proton mass when computing the center of mass energy. And so this is x1 times x2 times s. S is the center of mass energy squared for the proton-proton collision. All right, so 7, 8, or 13 TeV. Now, I can write down the cross section. I have pi squared gamma x to glue glue over 8 times mh times this delta function. It was s hat minus mh squared. I plug in s hat in terms of s. This is s times x1, x2 minus mh squared. And I can simplify this a little bit as follows. So I'll write this as delta of x2 minus a quantity tau over x1 times a factor of 1 over s x1. And I defined tau to be the following, mh squared over s. So what I'm trying to do is evaluate one of these integrals, the x2 integral, using the delta function. And so I'm just pulling out the factor of s times x1 outside the delta function, which is why it appears here. And then I have to divide by s in x1 in this term here. And that is this quantity tau over x1. So I'll use, so I'll evaluate this x2 integral using the delta function. So the delta function sets x2 to be equal to tau over x1. And remember, x2 had to be between 0 and 1, which means that this quantity tau also has to be between 0 and 1. So if I multiply both sides by x1, this tells me that 0 has to be less than tau, has to be less than x1. In particular, x1 has to be less than tau, or greater than tau. Oops. X1 also is between 0 and 1, so there's an upper bound as well. This has to be between tau and 1. So at the end of the day, doing the x2 integral with the delta function imposes a restriction on the remaining integral over x1. It's no longer between 0 and 1. It's now between tau and 1. Okay, so here's what we have. We have the remaining x1 integral, dx1 over x1, f of x1. Then we have f of x2. X2 is tau over x1. And then we have pi squared gamma of h to glu glu over 8mh times s. So this is the result for the cross section. And if you knew what the PDFs were, you could plug them in and do this integral, and then you have an answer for a given value of s. So unfortunately, there is no closed form analytic expression for these gluon PDFs. If you look in Peskin and Schroeder, there is a series of exercises having to do with Higgs decay. And in those exercises, they write down an analytic expression. So we'll call this the Peskin and Schroeder ansatz. And they take the following form, 8 over x times 1 minus x to the 7th power. I don't know if there's really a good motivation for any of this, but this is what they write down anyway. And so we can use this to actually do the integrals. So we'll do at the LHC, and this is going to be at leading order in alpha s. So we had three energies, 7 TeV, 8 TeV, and 13 TeV. We'll plug in this Peskin and Schroeder ansatz. For the gluon PDFs, and you get the following numbers after you do the integral. 5.3 picobarn, 6.8 picobarn, and then 15.7 picobarn. I just want to give you a sense of comparison. If you actually, you know, download some numerical files that give you the actual PDFs, you get the following numbers. Picobarn, 11.4, and 14.8. So I don't know how good this is to use this ansatz, but there we go. Now, this is just at leading order in the strong coupling constant, but at a hadron collider, next to leading order, QCD corrections are very important. And so I'll just write down what the state-of-the-art standard model calculations are for the rate, just so you can see how good we did. State of the art means next to leading order in alpha s. So this is order alpha s squared corrections compared to what we already wrote down. So at 7 TeV, 8 TeV, and 13 TeV. Get the following numbers, 15.1 picobarns, 19.3 picobarn, and 43.9 picobarn. So compared to the effect of the next to leading order corrections, you know, taking this really simplistic ansatz for the PDFs is not really a terrible approximation. But at the end of the day, okay, they're both kind of way off. So so QCD corrections are actually really important, as you can see numerically. Why are they so important? Well, at very high energies, you would say alpha S should be pretty small, perturbation theory should apply. But the reason is that you get these such large corrections is just because as you go to higher and higher orders, you have so many more diagrams to consider. So that's really the issue that's going on. Now, here are the cross-sections. Next, I want to talk about how many Higgs bosons are produced in the experiment. So to answer this question, I need to introduce the concept of luminosity. So what we're going to do is imagine a simplified version of a collider. So suppose we just have a uniform beam of particle A coming in, and some kind of uniform beam of particle B going in the other direction, and then they collide. Well, let me write down the rate of collisions. So what I'll write down is the collision rate per unit volume. This is the number density of particle A times the number density of particle B times the relative velocity times the cross section. So the collision rate is just what I wrote here on the left, on the right-hand side, times the relevant volume factor. So I should write down the NA times NB times V rel times the volume times the cross-section. What is the volume? It's the relevant area, relevant volume of overlap of the two beams. So the rate factorizes in terms of two quantities. The first is the cross-section. That's the particle physics things that we can compute. But then is all this other stuff that we don't really want to compute because it depends on the setup of the experiment. And so everything that multiplies the cross-section in determining the rate is known as the luminosity L. And then it has units of 1 over area times time. So there's another quantity known as the integrated luminosity. Which is denoted by dt integrated over L. So this is a sense that luminosity is related to the rate of the collisions. If we integrate over time, that's related to the number of collisions. So the integrated luminosity is just equal to the number of collisions per unit cross-section. Or if I want to phrase it in a different way, the number of events is equal to the integrated luminosity times the cross-section. So what is the integrated luminosity? That's a job for the experimentalists to determine, and they tell you. And then the job for the theorists is to compute the cross-section sigma. And then you have a prediction. So let's just plug in some numbers based on the Higgs discovery. So so it was discovered in 2012. And it was based on an integrated luminosity of around 5 inverse femtobarns at 7 TeV, plus around the same luminosity, same integrated luminosity at 8 TeV. Let me also mention one femtobarn is 10 to the minus 3 picobarns. And in case you're not sure about picobarn, one picobarn is 10 to the minus 12 barns. And one barn is 10 to the minus 24 centimeters squared. Barn is big, that's why it's called a barn. It's like a nuclear physics size cross section. But processes having to do with electroweak scales are much smaller than a barn. I should say the cross sections are much smaller, which is why we have to go to picobarns and also femtobarns. Okay, now let's see how many Higgs events there were. We just need to multiply luminosity times cross section. Do it at 7 TeV and 8 TeV. So we had 5 inverse femtobarns of luminosity at both energies. And the cross section at 7 TeV was 15.1 picobarn. Well, I could write this as 15.1 times 10 to the 3. Femtobarn. And this one was 19.3 times 10 to the 3 femtobarn. And so here we have around 75,000 Higgs events. And here we have around 100,000. Sounds like a lot of events. If you remember seeing the plots for the Higgs discovery, it looks like a tiny little bump, right? But of course, we have so many events. The reason that we only had a small little bump is just because not all of the Higgs decays are so readily observable. We can only really, well, we're looking for more and more now nowadays. But at first, we could only really detect the cleanest decay signatures from the Higgs. So the dominant decays in order are Higgs to BB bar. BB bar is tough because you produce lots of BB bar pairs through QCD. WW, that's also tough because even if you produce leptons, some of the energy from the Ws gets lost through neutrinos. The Ws that decay hadronically into quarks will also just look like, will look like hadrons, which is hard to distinguish. And then number three was Higgs to glu-glu, which we know is also tough. So all three of the dominant channels are really challenging. And so the cleanest ones are, as we mentioned, Higgs to gamma-gamma and Higgs to ZZ star, ZZ star. So in particular, this one is very attractive because it's very clean. But the branching ratio is around 0.15%. So I need to multiply these large number of events by the small branching ratio. So the number of Higgs to gamma gamma events is around 250. I haven't mentioned anything about experimental efficiencies or, you know, various cuts that you might impose to make sure that your events are very clean in the detector. So that will just reduce this number further. But there we go. So there were hundreds, order 100 events as of a few years ago. OK. Yes.
Again, before seeing the Higgs, we had no idea about its mass, because I think you mentioned it's not predicted. So we just need to like probe any mass scale until we find something?
Yeah. And so the way it worked historically is there was basically kind of an infinite range. We didn't really know what it was. OK, it can't be infinitely heavy. It has to be around the electron weak scale or lighter. But we didn't really know. If you look at some very ancient papers, people, you know, thought it could be very, very light, like a GeV or something like that. So it was always sort of right around the corner for a long time. Fast forward, there was sort of the LEP era. The electron positron machine running at CERN was looking for the Higgs. They didn't find anything up to around 114, 115 GeV. Then the Tevatron at Fermilab was also looking for the Higgs. They ended up closing sort of a higher mass window. I don't remember exactly, but somewhere around 150 to maybe 200, something like that. They closed that mass window. And so it was just a question of the leftover windows being sort of smaller and smaller and smaller. And eventually, in kind of the last available window that was left over, it appeared. That's the sort of the history of it. I forget. Did that answer your question? I forgot what your question was. Okay. Yeah.
I just wanted to know if people were like, "Oh yeah, it's this mass, sure," but probably not. Just like.
Right. So people, there was also a long game among theorists to try to predict what the Higgs mass should be based on different considerations like supersymmetry or some other considerations. So people have long tried to predict what the Higgs mass is. Probably the one, and it's weird that this ended up working out, was the one weird prediction that seemed to have worked was this paper from 2009 or so by Shaposhnikov and Wederich. What they predicted is that based on some unknown assumptions about the effect of quantum gravity at the Planck scale, perhaps you might imagine that the Higgs quartic coupling would be zero at that scale. With that assumption, if you run the Higgs quartic coupling down and then compute the Higgs mass based on that quartic at the electron weak scale, you end up getting, according to their paper, 126 GeV for the Higgs mass, which is kind of remarkable that they predicted that in 2009. But so that's something kind of strange. And so we don't really understand exactly, you know, why the Higgs quartic is the way it is. Maybe there's something deep about why it has to somehow vanish at the, you know, as you get up towards the Planck scale. We don't really understand.
Why does it have to be near the electroweak scale? I mean, the mass of the Higgs doesn't depend on this expectation value that we saw in the beginning. So I don't see why we should expect the same order of magnitude for the W mass and the. It's because of the.
Well, okay. So if you're a bottom-up kind of person like me, you would say that the Higgs VEV is fixed based on the Fermi constant. Okay, so it's 246. GeV, because we've measured G Fermi. Now the Higgs mass squared is lambda times V squared. Maybe there's some coupling, I don't remember, some number in front. So it can't be too heavy. The Higgs mass can't be too heavy unless you want lambda to be non-perturbatively large. So you can't go too high in terms of Higgs mass. Otherwise, the whole electroweak theory, which is based on a perturbative interaction, sort of breaks down. Okay. Any other questions? We're going to continue the discussion about collider phenomenology of the Higgs boson. And we only have a couple minutes left, so I'm just going to sort of set up the problem. So I want to talk about the parity of the Higgs boson. So far I've kind of framed experimental tests of the Higgs boson in terms of probing all of the different couplings between the Higgs and the standard model. Remember, it's predicted unambiguously in terms of the corresponding masses of those particles. But we also have a prediction just in terms of the quantum numbers of the Higgs boson. In the standard model, the Higgs boson is a scalar with even parity. And so we want to test the quantum numbers of the Higgs experimentally to verify that it really is a zero plus state. So what are the different possibilities that we could have? Well, Higgs has observed decaying into pairs of bosons. So that tells you that the Higgs has to have an integer parity. So 0, 1, or 2, theories with spin larger than 2 are problematic. But 0, 1, and 2 we can consider. The case where you have spin 1 is excluded. Based on the Higgs to gamma gamma observation. And this is due to the Landau Yang theorem. If you don't remember, Landau Yang tells you that a massive spin 1 particle cannot decay into a pair of identical massless spin 1 particles. And the only assumptions are rotational invariance and symmetry of the final state since they're bosons. So this possibility is excluded, but we could still have spin 1. So we want to distinguish, we want to distinguish spin 0 from spin 2, and also even parity versus odd parity. Spin 2, you might not say, is too so attractive, but you might have a theory with some kind of massive graviton. In that case, this state could be that. How do we know it's a scalar? OK, so this is what we're going to talk about on tomorrow. And in particular, we're just going to focus on the following. So we're going to focus on the difference between the standard model scalar versus a pseudoscalar. So a CP even state versus a CP odd state. So we're going to ask, how can you distinguish between these two possibilities experimentally? OK, so that will be tomorrow. All right, so we'll adjourn here for today.